The Rewind with Henry McKean.
You're very welcome to The Rewind with me, Henry McKean, where we take a nostalgic look back on a year. Today, we're going back to the 90s. The year is 1994. The Rainbow Coalition has formed with Labour, Fine Gael and Democratic Left. And Bertie Ahern becomes the leader of the opposition. Boyzone come into their own. Nelson Mandela becomes the first black president of South Africa. O.J. Simpson is arrested and charged with the murder of his ex-wife Nicole and friend Ronald Goldman and is eventually found not guilty. And Ireland compete in the USA World Cup finals. Stay with us for the next hour as we rewind to 1994. I asked these people about their memories.
I think it was videotapes. Record everything on video at that time.
Nowadays, you don't have to video anything because we have it all on the phone, on the mobile, and that's it.
You know? You had the VHS, and that was the most modern thing you had back in 1994.
Oh, God, 1994, please. Let's just concentrate on the noughties. The 90s, I bought my house.
And can I ask you what you paid for it?
Went for a 3-bed semi-D, 120,000.
So you were happy?
More than happy. I'm still there, yes.
And what are your memories?
My daughter graduated from UCD and went straight to London, much to my disappointment.
Well, I was younger and I drank and there was very little money about. Money was scarce.
The summer of 1994 saw the country fall into football frenzy as the national team reached the last 16 at the World Cup. In the United States, everybody remembers the most exciting moment in 1994, that iconic Ray Houghton goal versus Italy. Take a listen.
Sheridan. Sparesi, onto it comes Houghton. And Houghton with a shot, and it's there! Ray Houghton! Bring me back, and I'll do the job for you, Jack. And he's done just that.
Memories there, 1994. And joining us on the line is Ray Houghton right now. 30 years have passed. You're very welcome to The Rewind. I'm Henry McKean. Tell me, how are you feeling all these years later?
Amazing. It's great that, the public still recognise that moment. It's still there, etched in my memory, of course. And everyone who was there, you know, I remember going to the game that day on the coach and we were told it was going to be 75% Italian supporters at the game and 25% Irish. When we were travelling on the bus, we were like, where's all the Italians? Because all we could see was Irish fans going to the game. So we knew that we were going to have a great support in the stadium. It was just absolutely fantastic. To play in the World Cup again after 1990, playing against the team that knocked us out in the quarterfinal. So we were looking for a bit of revenge, to be honest with you, Henry, and, delighted that we got the win that day.
And, you know, it really was or is iconic. It was very, very hot, hot summer day. I remember watching back home in Ireland on TV. It was extremely hot. And you've talked about how players on the pitch actually lost weight because of the sweating. It was that warm.
Oh, yeah, it was absolutely incredible. Even in training sessions and the build-up to the game itself when we were based in Orlando, you know, some of the goalkeepers and some of the centre-backs were losing upwards of £9 per training session. It was quite incredible, yeah. The heat was at times unbearable. Fortunately, it wasn't as hot for us in New Jersey as it was down in Orlando. Orlando was a lot hotter. And obviously the timing of the game was a little bit different, but still to come out into the stadium, just with so many Irish supporters in there and the national anthems are being played and, you know, you're ready for whatever was going to come your way. And we knew it was going to be a very difficult game for us.
And, you know, the crowd, you talked about the crowd and, you know, the Italians thought they had it. The Italians thought they would win and the giant stadium, the Irish came out of the woodwork. Even now, 30 years later, you still get stopped in the street, I'm sure. Like, and we've got to remember also that, you know, you played across clubs, across England, Liverpool, West Ham and Aston Villa 500 times. But it's this moment, if I can say that, and you can disagree with me, that captures the imagination of fans everywhere.
Yeah, well, there's no bigger competition to play in as a football player than the World Cup. for me personally, you know, that was the pinnacle of your career. To play in the quarterfinals against Italy in 1990, to score one of the penalties against Romania in 1990 as well was fantastic. But to score the winning goal against Italy in the manner that it happened, you know, with my weaker left foot, it was one of them occasions anyway when I took the shot. I mean, my first reaction was it was going over the crossbar. My second reaction was the goalkeeper's going to save it. And my third and final reaction was it's in. And then I was just off and running. And after the game, I was asked about my goal celebration, which in Birmingham, where I was playing for Aston Villa at the time, it's called a gamble.
Yeah.
So I said to people afterwards, I said, what are you talking about? My celebration, and I didn't have many playing at the national level, was just put my hand up. You know, that was it. It's as simple as that. But it was only later on that I realised what I'd done and then the embarrassment of it, I'll be honest. But I've been asked on many occasions in the last 30 years if I can replicate it. And the older I get, yeah, the more I say, no, that's well out of the question now. But it's just listening to speak to yourself and, yeah, you know, to all the listeners, you know, to give them some memory about that day 30 years on is incredible. You know, it's for all the lads that was there playing, you know, on that occasion, for the manager, Jack Charlton, and Maurice Setters are no longer with us. You know, they're a huge loss to the football community. It was great times. It was no better time to be an international footballer with Ireland than during that period with Jack. It was absolutely sensational.
And of course, with Jack Charlton, it was a really, really special time. And even talking to you now, 30 years on, I feel like I'm touching something special, something gold. And the Irish people too. I mean, they're still basking in your glory. Do you wake up in the middle of the night sometimes and think, oh my God, wow. Is it with you every day?
Yeah, yes, it is. There's no doubt. You know, there's no better feeling. You know, you can look back in your career and there's lots of games that I've played in. There's games that, funny enough, I was speaking to someone the other day about this, that said you scored in this particular match. And I was like, did I? I don't remember. And yet, with the Ireland games, I could virtually tell you, you know, particularly in 88 when I scored against England, 1990, the games we played there, and certainly 1994. They're very, very fresh in my memory. They really are, because they mean so much to you. You know, as I said, it was just an incredible time to be a sportsman representing Ireland. You know, it was absolutely fantastic. Not just for the players, I think with the fans as well, because we went from, you know, gates of 10,000 to full houses, 35,000-37,000 at Lansdowne Road. That's how much appeal the Irish team had. That was a breakthrough time, I think, for Irish football, where everyone, you know, just got on board with the Irish setup, and it was absolutely brilliant to be around.
And it is USA 94. Is it your best football memory?
I'm often asked, what's your favourite goal that you scored? And as I said to you earlier, I didn't score that many. I always thought I was an assister of goals rather than a goal scorer. But no, actually, the one is 1988 England. Mm-hmm. For a variety, yes, of factors. One, it was the first time Ireland has ever, yep, qualified for a major tournament. But it was my first international goal.
Yeah.
And it's something in life you always remember. And to score against England and to beat them was, when you factor that all into the mix, that's why it was so important to me.
And that was absolutely huge. Well, look, I just want to thank you and the listeners, everyone, want to say thank you. Ray Houghton, thank you so much for chatting to The Rewind. And let's keep this special memory going forever.
Thanks very much.
The Rewind with Henry McKean.
Now we're going to talk about Boyzone, one of Ireland's first and biggest manufactured boy bands. Louis Walsh put an advert in the paper, 300 applied, and here is a clip from the Late Late Show.
Okay, well, who is who now? You identify yourself.
I'm Ronan Keating.
Ronan Keating, where are you from?
I'm from Swords.
From Swords, yeah. Okay, and who are you?
I'm Mark Walton.
Mark Walton from?
Raheny.
Raheny.
Keith Duffy. Raheny.
Raheny.
Shane Lynch. Raheny.
Richard Rock. That mine's.
Stephen Gayton. Seventh place.
I was told you don't play any instruments at all, none of you.
There's a lot of liars out there.
I was also told that you don't sing at all, none of you.
Oh, no. Jesus.
And knowing that you don't play, you don't sing, and you can't write music, I thought you'd go very far, but now you've wrecked the whole thing, you see.
Is there some realistic talent?
No, they've no talent whatsoever. Nothing. They've no talent whatsoever. They don't sing, they don't write music, and they don't play instruments. So you won't be playing any instruments, and you won't be singing. It'll all be backing track on the stage when you actually go.
Well, when we go.
You don't sing, do you? No.
I do.
Oh, you do? Very good.
You don't play any instruments or have any songs?
No.
You do?
They don't.
They don't.
They're lying. They don't.
We're not going to sing. We're going to do a bit of dance.
Oh, they're going to do a dance for us. Oh, I see. You're going to do a bit of dance.
Well done, thank you. You're great movers. Well done. Good luck. Good luck. We look forward to hearing from you when you're famous.
I caught up with this man who made the Boyzone music videos out on Island Bridge in Dublin.
I'm here with Bill Hughes, producer, broadcaster, and gay activist. Bill, tell us about your involvement with Boyzone. How did it all happen? And obviously, 1994 was a massive year for them.
Well, in Dublin, everybody is just a phone call away. And so I happened to be just at the wrong end of the phone the day Louis Walsh was looking for somebody to make a pop video for his boys.
So you picked up the phone.
Yeah, well, I would always answer Louis. You know, is Louis Walsh, what does he want now? And or is he asking to bring me to a concert or something? Or, you know, that were, or are we meeting for coffee for a good gossip about something? No. He had... I've put this boy band together. They're going to be Ireland's answer to Take That. And I said, Louis, I saw them on the Late Late. They're not.
And that was it in, you know, the autumn of 1993.
Yeah.
They were on the Late Late.
Yeah.
And it didn't go well, did it?
It was a joke. It was a joke because the point was Louis wanted to make a splash. And he knew that all publicity is good publicity in Louis' world. And he was right. Because it was just about publicity and getting them onto the Late Late Show, which was the biggest show at the time, and getting Uncle Gabo, Gay Byrne, to, you know, introduce them and stuff. And sure, Gabo was perplexed. The boys were perplexed. The audience were appalled. Everybody looked at it and just went, what in the name of God was that? And then the way he told them all to freak out, you know, do your dance and do your stuff. And Jesus, you just cover your eyes. And, you know, to this day, all of the boys are so embarrassed by that footage. But everybody has to start somewhere. And that's where Boyzone began.
And they are. I mean, they started, obviously, there was another member, Ronan Keating, the late Stephen Gately, Shane Lynch, Keith Duffy, and Mikey Graham.
They brought in Mikey, yeah. Mikey came in after the Late Late.
And looking back on it, here we are, all these years later, they've had such a run. But we're going to talk about your involvement and these music videos. And back then, a music video was everything. It could make or break a song.
Oh, yeah.
And you know, getting it on Top of the Pops, getting it played on, you know, Saturday, children's television, and obviously MTV was everything. It was huge. And this is obviously before YouTube and before social media. These videos, they were massive. They meant so much. What were you trying to achieve?
The brief was make them look gorgeous, make them look like angels, make every little girl fall in love with them so that they'll have a solid fan base. That was it. The brief was that simple. Make them look like some kind of romantic hero. And I talked to Peter Robinson, the cinematographer, and the director of photography, and I said, what are we going to do to make them look good? And he said, it's all in the lighting and it's all in the filters and whatever filters we can put on them. And John Reynolds, who owned Pod Nightclub and was Louis's partner in Boyzone, said, well, there's the location. So we just got together and Louis said, you do the video. Well, the very first video was Working My Way Back to You. And that was just a joke. That was done where News Talk is now.
So that was an old dance studio
Diggs
kind of thing?
Diggs Lane studio. And we were up on the roof and we did Working My Way Back to You. And it was just horrendous. But there was zero budget. And then when it came to Love Me For a Reason, Louis said, you know, I only have like $2,000. $2,000 is all I can do.
$2,000? Yeah. I mean, you had, you know, the American pop stars spending $1 million.
Listen, Louis, I'm going to have to pay the cameraman and I'm going to have to pay for the film stock and I will pull favours that we get the edit for nothing and the processing for nothing and we'll do, you know, all of those kind of things. So can you get them dressed? Can you get their makeup done?
So yeah, I mean, you talked there about the roof of News Talk, and Diggs Lane was an old studios. You know, so there's a bit of Boyzone, you know, amongst us, amongst the whole building.
Absolutely. We tried to give it a little bit of street cred. We had them dressed in tracky bottoms and little singlets and stuff, and it just drew attention to the fact that Ronan and Stephen had never been in a gym. You know, whereas Keith and Shane were kind of the beef and the muscle in the background. And then Mikey, and at the time, Mikey was considered to possibly be the lead singer. And he did sing co-lead on Working My Way Back to You. But that was all different. We did it on the roof of Diggs Lane, and that is now News Talk.
And it was done on a strict budget. Were you surprised? You know, no budget. Were you surprised how big, you know, how big the songs became, how the videos were played basically on rotation? They still are on some pop channels.
Henry, I was surprised that the song charted in Ireland, this first one. And I said to Louis, it's selling. Look, I mean, it's selling. And he said, get over yourself. Come over here. And he brought me to his Jeep and he opened the boot of his Jeep and it was full of CDs. And he said, that's why it's charted.
So he bought them in certain
of course,
shops.
Yes, of course he did. But then it created a bit of interest. And so Love Me For A Reason was a different kettle of fish because they were going to get interest from smash hits. And when I made the video, Louis said, think of smash hits. Think of the smash hits audience. Think of the young girls who are the screaming fans. And like, there I was, you know, man of a certain age going, what empathy would I have with these screaming fans? But we made Love Me For A Reason and it did become a phenomenon. And it sold, you know, over 500,000 copies in the UK, went to number 2 in the charts in the UK and ended up on Top of the Pops, ended up on every chart show. And I was like, oh, this is a bit of my work out there. It's not work I'm necessarily proud of, but it's out there.
And did it lead to other work? I mean, did Michael Jackson ring you for a video? I mean, did it work out in the long run because so many of you did it for free?
No, see, doing it for free was my biggest mistake, because when you do something for free, nobody respects you and nobody respects the decisions you made or the artistic decisions you made. And you're making a contribution to somebody else's career, but it's instantly disposable. The one thing, when I made the third video, which was Key to My Life, there was a marvellous manager called Kees van Leeuwen. He was leading the Dutch boy band kind of resurgence, and he had a Dutch boy band called Caught in the Act, and he said, we love what you did on Key to My Life, could you do that for us? And he sent me their latest song, and I said I could, and I told him a proper budget, and he said sure, didn't bat an eyelid.
Wow.
And I got paid for that.
So there you go, it worked out. Yeah. In the end. Yeah. And what were they like back then? What were Boyzone like? Was there an ego, or were they easygoing? Could they believe their luck?
The difference between the Boyzones that showed up for the very first day of the very first video, like Ronan and Stephen were like two little church mice. The deal was I would pick them up outside the old Virgin Megastore on the Quays. They were standing there in their little singlets. They had their outfits for the day in Dunstore's bags. They were in their little tracky bottoms, and they got into the back of my car, and they were, yes, Mr. Hughes, no, Mr. Hughes. And I said, it's Bill, yes, Mr. Hughes. I said, no, it's Bill, call me Bill. But they couldn't get their heads around it. And that was the very first day. Now, that lasted all of a week, because then it wasn't just Mr. Hughes. It was, they decided to christen me. They gave me a derogatory girl's name, and that became the relationship. And it was fine. It was absolutely fine. We did get on like a house on fire for the period I was making the videos. And I ended up making 5 of the videos. And they just got, each one got bigger and bigger and bigger. And they started spreading across Europe. And I thought, okay, any minute now, my kerching will come in and I'll get paid for the next video. Not at all. Louis would phone me and say, listen, I have to make another video. Now, I don't have any money.
He never paid you?
No. Well, paid the costs, and the costs went up. So the costs went from 2 grand to 5 grand to 10 grand to 15 grand to 28 grand. That was it.
And nothing for you?
Well, you know, like I had the joy of doing it.
And are you proud 30 years on and think, I was a part of that? I was a part of Boyzone.
Oh, yeah, of course. It was a phenomenon, and it was a cultural moment. Pop music was the staple of my growing up. And so Boyzone were the staples of so many people's growing up. And to this day, there are people who say, oh, you were involved with Boyzone. What were they like? Like, they were grand. They were just a group of young fellas who were chancing their arm, and it paid off.
Well, Bill Hughes, producer, broadcaster, and gay activist, and the man behind five of the original, or many of the Boyzone videos. Thank you so much for chatting to us on The Rewind.
Thanks, Henry. No.
The Rewind with Henry McKean.
Welcome back to The Rewind with me, Henry McKean. Today, we are rewinding 30 years to 1994. It was the year of the Labour Dick Spring Fianna Fáil Albert Reynolds government that eventually collapsed. And then the Rainbow Coalition of Fine Gael, Democratic Left and Labour were formed. And Bertie Ahern became the leader of Fianna Fáil, going on to win 3 elections. I caught up with Bertie in Drumcondra, and we rewind to 1994.
Thank you, Henry, and very nice to look back 30 years, a long time ago. And of course, 1994 was a really good year. It was a busy year for me. I was Minister of Finance through all that year. The economy had bounced back from the problems with the exchange rate mechanism. The interest rates had dropped. Employment was rising, and I think we were into one of our few positive deficits. We were in credit that year in the country, and you know it was really a good time. And of course, 1994 was an exciting time. Riverdance was great in the point, and I'd been involved in the early days of getting the point up and running. So it was great to be there for that event, and to showcase the Dublin keys all over the world, so and particularly Europe. And then, of course, that was the time I probably remember best with my sport and hat. It was a great period for the sport because, of course, we were off to America for the games. I was at the Italian match, and that was a wonderful, wonderful day. I remember all the Italian supporters wishing us well in the game, thinking they'd hammer us, and then when we won it, they weren't so pleasant. So it was a great occasion, and of course it was a great summer for Dublin GAA because we should have won it that year, but we had the 91, we had the 4 in a row with Meath, 92 we beat Derry, 93 we lost to Donegal in the final. In 94 we were beaten by Down, so it's but it was a great few years to be following Dublin. 94 was really a particular time. And then of course politically it was the ceasefires in August 94, which was probably the biggest event really of the year, because that was the first ceasefire of the troubles in the north, the first break we'd had since 68-69 and Albert Reynolds' government. So that was in the back of the Downing Street Declaration, which happened just late in 93. And then, of course, unfortunately, we ran into political difficulties, and it was the change of administrations. I was almost Taoiseach for a few weeks, and then I wasn't.
And you write about that in your biography, the fact that, you know, you're getting a team ready. It was a difficult year politically. And, you know, you nearly were Taoiseach in 94, but you also say having those 3 years to prepare and get ready was actually quite helpful.
Yeah, it was. There's no doubt about it. I mean, I'd been a minister for a long time. I'd been minister since March 87. I'd been Minister of State back in 1982. But so I'd been in government. But in finance, you're tied fairly much to the office. And you know, while it was a good time for the Irish economy, it was a lot of the foundations of the success of the Irish economy at that time was built up in those early 90s, and on the back of social partnership from 87 on. And of course, it was disappointing. I think I was to be elected Taoiseach on a Wednesday or something like that, and it all collapsed on the Tuesday morning. So it was fairly tight. But in hindsight, it gave me a chance to reorganise the party, to build up the party. And then I went on the road from 95, 96. And, you know, by 97, we were in a very good place. And, you know, we came back and won that 97 election. So I think in hindsight, having the opportunity to be leader of the opposition and gain a lot of experience and involve myself a lot with the North, because at that time, the ceasefire had happened. Albert was gone, unfortunately. But then I had the mantle, so it gave me a chance of building my contacts in the North, which I did, you know, after that, and built up the contacts with Tony Blair. So if I had worked out different, if I had been Taoiseach, I might have had that run into it.
Because you did, you spent quite a bit of time up in the North, you know, when it was, I suppose, unfashionable to do that, when you were in opposition. And you think that really helped push that peace process, which is, we're sticking to 94 in 1998. You think it helped?
Oh, it did. There's no doubt about it, because, you know, 94 being the biggest, I mean, 94 was that lead-in, that long lead-in in August to the ceasefire. And then, you know, the IRA ceasefire was the end of August. Then the Loyalists is in October. So, you know, in terms of the North, that was the huge barometer of where we were going. So the work that was done from there on in always leading to 1998. So I think when you look at the period, you have to look at 94. You have to look at, you know, the success of the Downing Street Declaration, which was the start, the end of Christmas 93 and into 94. And then the run to the ceasefires, which took all that time, and then the Loyalist ceasefires, and then, you know, the changes down here in the government. So it was a momentous year, there's no doubt about it.
And I know you talk about that in your News Talk podcast, as I remember it. I'm going to bring you back to style and to fashion, and you talk about, you know, Louis Copeland and how you got rid of the anorak and you actually you raised money by getting rid of the anorak.
Yeah.
And, you know, style and fashion and having to look smarter when you became leader of Fianna Fáil, that must have been a big change back in 94.
Yeah, well, it was difficult for the guys who were trying to advise me because I wasn't much into it. I'd been used to, you know, my dad was farm manager in All Hallows, so we were used to working on the land and the fields. And when I wasn't in that, I was in my tracksuit. All of my brothers were into sport, my sisters were into sport, so we tended to live in the tracksuit. So having to get into this suit and get your suit done all the time and get it, you know, getting cleaned and pressed continually wasn't into me. But the late PJ Mara, who was also from Drumcondra, and a few of my good friends, you know, said, no, you have to do this. This is the way you have to do it. But anyway, getting my hair cut for me was painful enough because I used a very long hair in my early years in politics.
And you'd be young. I mean, you're still young, but you were in your early 40s in 1994.
Yeah. I was only in the early 40s. But, it was a good time because, you know, while unemployment was growing and, you know, things were really beginning to improve, but a lot of the industries, and one of the great things, I mean, you get a bit of luck, when I was in finance that time, a lot of the industries, the pharmaceutical, the ICT companies that have now gone on to be great companies, they came here during that period. So I did a lot of the road shows to Silicon Valley and other things, you know, to convince them of the benefits of Ireland with IDA guys, and, you know, it was an exciting period. And you know, the reason we had a recession later on, but the reason we got in and out of a recession very quickly, which we did as against other countries, because we had the backbone of those industries. And you know, those industries that came in around that time, the early 90s, mainly predominantly American, were hugely important to us and are to this day. I mean, that's where we're getting the corporation taxes now.
The money's still rolling in thanks to all these big social media companies. And also, you know, people don't talk about this. You were doing, on average, 18-hour days.
Yeah, there were long days. In Department of Finance, I always say, you know, teaching is a busy job and the book stops you to teach it. But in terms of hours in finance, they kind of split the role now. They have two ministers in finance, but in those days there was one. But it was demanding because, you know, there wasn't as much money in the country. You had to keep a watch on everything. You had all the groups, the interest groups wanted to see you. You had to do the pre-budget submissions. And it was a demanding time. There wasn't the technology there is now in preparation of a lot of, and getting data as quick as you can now, which is terrific. But it was, and all the companies that used to come to Ireland, the IDA would wheel them in to Minister of Finance to outline where the country was going. You know, social partnership was the big thing at that time, and fairness to the employers and the unions, social pillar. So, you know, it was busy and tough, but you had to be, like, I was in the office usually in the morning, about my normal routine was being in, you know, shortly after 7:30, and if I got out at 9:30, 10 o'clock, I felt nearly I got out early.
Yeah, half day. And Bertie Hearn, you went viral before we knew what viral was back then. That moment in the Dáil where you lost your temper and you introduced me to the word waffler. Tell us, you're still dining out on it, and it's viral now, but back then we didn't have viral.
It's still a YouTube all the time. Yeah, what happened that day was Albert Reynolds was under terrible pressure, huge pressure, and the opposition kind of got control of the Dáil and started dictating the times and dictating when the House should sit, and the opposition were beginning to get above themselves. So I was sitting beside Albert, and they were putting first, but I left fly at them anyway, and I gave them a bit, and they weren't used to me doing that, so I think they sat back in their seats and behaved themselves for a while.
And do people still, you know, like heckle you and say you're a waffler? Do you still get it?
Funny enough, I was very strange in the recent British election. I think it must have been the Labour guys were attacking some of the Tories, and they started calling them up, but people were sending me the clip and it was well remembered. But I remember the following morning some people said, that was great, you gave it, and other people said, oh no, that isn't like you, don't do that. So the opinion was mixed.
Answer the question.
Nobody smokes green.
Nobody doing.
Perhaps if you stop waffling. If you stop waffling, we might get some work done. You're a waffler. You've been years around here waffling.
Bertie Hearn there. This is The Rewind with me, Henry McKean, going back 30 years to 1994. Up next, Britpop and pop fiction. The arts of 94.
The Rewind.
With Henry McKean.
Welcome back to The Rewind with me, Henry McKean. I caught up with pop culture expert and podcaster David O'Callaghan beside his microphone, and we go back 30 years. We start by talking about his podcast.
It's Here and Back Again is the name of the podcast, and it's basically a weekly look at streaming, movies, music, pop culture, and what's happening. So there's so much happening right now, it keeps you up to date weekly about what's happening, what's dropping, and what's happening gossip boys.
Okay, so we're now going back 30 years. What? The Rewind, it's 1994. I watched Shawshank on VHS, and it was a huge home video spectacular. Yeah. And it went on and on and on. And I accidentally was walking past the Savoy on O'Connell yes. Street in 1994, and there was a big queue outside. And at the time, I was under 18, and I said to the people in the queue, why are you all queuing up? And they're like, oh, this is an amazing movie. It's from America called Pulp Fiction. And we managed to get past, you know, into the cinema. All of us were a good bit under 18, actually. And it blew our minds. Bring out the gimp. Yeah. I mean, obviously, there's lots of lines in it.
Yeah, that's definitely, that was a college favourite for at least 6 months. Also that year, we had Leon, Luc Besson's brilliant with Jean Reno. And then animation-wise, Disney had got its mojo back animation-wise, and that was the year of The Lion King. But the big winner of the year, and people will argue whether it was a winner or a loser over time, was Forrest Gump. At the time, I absolutely adored it. I still like it, but it's ultimately beige when you compare it to Pulp Fiction. Yeah,
absolutely. And when we take time, it hasn't aged that well. We thought the graphics, we thought the special effects were amazing, but we look back on it now, not so much.
Well, it won 7 Academy Awards, so it has them in the bag, so it beat out. And when you, again, it's a classic case of how did that beat that? But anyway, and then the other kind of, I'd like to think of Forrest Gump as the Coldplay of movies, but that's just me. And finally, Four Weddings and a Funeral. Yes, everybody went absolutely mad for that. And that kind of leads perfectly into the music section, because of Four Weddings and a Funeral, a small little song by a band called Wet 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 became iconic and record breaking, because at the time Top of the Pops was still a thing here for us as well, and Love Is All Around went for 15 weeks in a row at number one.
And I feel it in my fingers, I feel it in my toes, and it really was absolutely huge every time we would tune into Top of the Pops. It was number one and number one again and again and again and again.
Just for the whole summer, people were like, oh, get it.
And I can remember Marty Pello's ponytail. I can still see it.
So that was wrecking our heads. While for those looking at Christmas, the Christmas number one that year was E17, Stay Another Day. I did love it.
Christmassy, though. They added some bells.
No, they had the white jackets and they're in the snow. The song wasn't about Christmas, but it was a great song. But that's just me, boy band, love it.
And still on the albums, still there on the Christmas specials.
Yeah, so then, again, with that year, the Eurovision year that year, this is when Ireland could win things in the Eurovision. Paul Harrington and Charlie McGettigan won with Rock and Roll Kids. And just as importantly, was a small 7-minute interval session. That was the year of Riverdance. People's, again, little minds blew because we're like, what is happening here? Like, I think it became almost, it was bigger than Eurovision that year nearly.
And it's still there. It's still touring. It's still playing. Riverdance was a phenomenon and still is.
Yeah, it's crazy how that kind of thing became what it was. Now, I know what you're thinking. You're like, my God, this is the most dull year for music you've ever heard in your life. However, there was one word that became the buzzy word and the buzzy scene of the year, and that was Britpop, because that was the year of Britpop. So we had Blur with Park Life versus Oasis, Definitely Maybe, but also Suede and Pulp had their debut albums that year. So an unbelievable scene for music. Like, it was such a thing. Like, people were going crazy for it. Like, now it became a media thing, but for music to get the high kind of a feature on news and everywhere you look, it was there. So that was brilliant. But also, that year we had Green Day. That was their debut album, Dookie, came out. Prodigy, Music for the Gilded Generation. The Cranberries released their, it wasn't their debut, but they released it, No Need to Argue, which people loved. And Jeff Buckley released Grace. But also that year, Nirvana, they've been around a while, but they released the famous MTV Unplugged.
And Unplugged was absolutely massive. And you mentioned Britpop, and I know they said it in Father Ted, but this was the conversation we used to have. You'd say to someone in the street at the bus stop, you would say Blur or Oasis.
Yeah.
I'm going to say that to you, Blur or Oasis?
Oasis at the time, because I had all the gear. And then I've kind of warmed to Blur over the years, but I still think Oasis, those first two albums, it was unbelievable. Like,
okay, yeah, well, for me, it was Blur. It's still Blur.
Yeah. And that's it. People kind of, and then you can argue, why can't we all just get along and like both? But then the bands themselves didn't like, you know,
and it worked for
them.
They
ramped it up. They were probably all hanging out backstage laughing at everybody.
I think they were friends. I mean, they were selling something like 400,000 copies a week each. I mean, it was huge business.
Yeah, it was good. It was good for them to be enemies. Yeah, and now they're just all grumpy old men, but that's the way it is. As I mentioned, MTV Unplugged, Nirvana, but also, sadly, that was the year of Kurt Cobain's death. So they released the album early in the year, and then obviously he passed away. So that was kind of a... The music scene was absolutely brilliant at the time. Little other nuggets before we get to TV, because there was a lot of TV. Sony PlayStation launched at the end of 1994. The first ever Sony
that
PlayStation.
That early?
Yeah.
1994?
Yeah, I'm trying to think. I was like, I probably had a ZX Spectrum, no, my luck back then. But
Commodore 64 in my
house. Yeah, it was a thing. And anybody who's... Because people are always interested in celebrity babies. 1994 was a pretty good year. You had Harry Styles, Justin Bieber and Saoirse Ronan are 1994 babies.
So they were the 1994 babies, and look at them now. When you go back to 1994, 30 years ago, we rewind back to that time. For me, it feels like maybe 5 years ago. It doesn't feel like 30 years ago. Mobile phones, you know, some people had them. I mean, the internet was coming a bit later. It was still very much magazines and stuff like that, wasn't
it? Yeah, no, it was magazines and there was trips to the cinema, like just big days out. And all these bands are doing these tours, the 30-year tour. And it freaks you out when you kind of go, oh my God, that's 30. Like, I just went to see Green Day doing Dookie. And you're like, that's 30 years? Like, you know, and then, so all these bands, these iconic bands are still playing, fairness to them, but they're playing that, like, the albums completely. Like, and there's a lot of that.
So there's a lot of nostalgia, and I actually still struggle to be nostalgic about 1994. I came across this meme. I'm just going to read it to you. It just says, 1994, I can't wait to see what the world is like in 30 years. 2024. I miss 1994.
It was a good time. It was an innocent time. But it was just, at the time, we're probably all giving out. But when you look back at the pop culture this year, between music, TV and movies, it was stuff that has lasted so long. Like, and it's actually almost going full. There's reboots. There's, as I said, these tours happening of bands who are still existing 30 years later. And a lot of the bands from other years made just disappeared into the ether and all that.
And when we look at style, and when we look at the fact that the Gen Zs right now are dressing up like as if it's 1994 again, which I feel uncomfortable. I'm like, I bought that tracksuit because I didn't have any money to buy anything better. And you've gone out and bought that because it's fashionable, but it was never fashionable. I want to go over and say that to them.
Are you being ironic? Or what is actually happening? Like, I'm shock to everybody. I'm getting my hair cut today, and based on the TV at the time, I'd be going in now getting my Rachel haircut. Like, it's because Friends was 1994.
And
like.
Friends, if we talk about Friends was absolutely massive. It still is, thanks to Netflix and what have you. You know, and obviously we lost one of the characters, which was very, very sad. So there's only five of them left, Matthew Perry. And for you, you know, were you an ER person? Did you like a hospital drama? Because they are still big business.
Yeah, and they had existed before that, but I was never a massive. But then ER came along and suddenly I'm shouting out, get the lidocaine stat. I didn't know what was going on. Like, it was the smooth charm of a certain Mr. George Clooney that kind of got people in the door. But then it was just the dynamic. It was very cleverly done. It wasn't the way the drama kind of unfolded every week. It was just something different that, Friends was quick hit, funny, half an hour gone, whereas this was like you got involved with these characters. And there was a revolving door. I completely forgot that William H. Macy was in at the start.
And it was a quality programme, and you could see the money on screen. I mean, they had good actors, good script writers. It was entertaining. And back then, you would have to wait. You'd have to wait for the next.
Well, that's it. Yeah, it's not like it's not like dropping 10 episodes like this. This people like it, when you talk to the young kids these days, and you're like, oh, no, we had to like wait a week. Like we there was no kind of dropping of the whole binge. Binge didn't exist, and it was like you'd be waiting on a Sunday night at 9 o'clock, and you'd be because there was no way to see it except live, like unless you could get to record, and not everybody was recording things. So, but you became like a family thing or a Friends thing, not Friends, a TV show, but you became comfortable with appointment TV, I suppose, is what I'm trying to say. And that was the big thing around then as well. And it always has been before streaming came in. Appointment TV kind of
everyone
exists
would
now
be
then.
Home watching it, and a series back then was 26. 26 shows. They were long, and they would bang them out. I mean, they really were churning the stuff out. You know, is TV as good now these days?
Well, that's it. So much. Like, I suppose that you could argue, you make your own TV with streaming now, and that's why for me, I do the podcast is to make sense of it all. You are in charge of making your own TV. There's no ads there, and you're just planning, I'll watch this then. But sometimes there's still kind of appointment TV, like a House of the Dragon or whatever the next big show is. Back then, a show like My So-Called Life, which at the time, very few people watched. It only lasted one season. It was Claire Danes and Jared Leto, teen angst, kind of high school-y type thing. Now it's like, oh my God, My So-Called Life is like when you become a teenager, it's like you have to watch it. It's become a thing.
And it was so big, and it made stars of the two of
them. Yeah, like over the years, I mean, you think back who was in it and what it became. It was just fantastic. But again, they only made the one season though. I think it was 10 episodes or something like that.
So it became iconic.
Absolutely, a cult classic, iconic. And speaking of cult classic, but less iconic, Party of Five was a thing that it was one of those kind of, if you remember 30 something, that kind of grown up version of My So-Called Life. So in this, you had Neve Campbell, Matthew Fox, and Jennifer Love Hewitt, and it was like these five, this family of five siblings whose parents passed away, and they had to just deal with growing up quicker than they should, and it just was a thing. So people were totally into Party of Five. Over time, it probably, there's people who still remember, but it hasn't become the classic that people remember. Whereas My So-Called Life, as I keep saying, people, oh my god, you have to watch this. And then I suppose the final TV show to highlight was The Fast Show, came out in 1994 with Charlie Higson and Paul Whitehouse as their sketch show, which kind of depicted and took a stab at British stereotypes. So that's where people walking around with, you know, catchphrases like suit juicer, or Scorchio. So when you're looking through, you kind of go, oh my god, that was that year, and that's the thing. And then when you line it all up and you list all those things, you kind of go, wow, that is a pretty decent year. Like,
you must have needed some prize bazookas in your time, as you Americans like to call them, sir.
What?
Have you ever added it up, sir? Must be a bewildering number.
What? Gushing torrent of young ladies.
An avalanche of quim.
A mountain of minge. Cornucopia of
suit you, sir.
And that's it for The Rewind 1994 with me, Henry McKean. Big thanks to Hugh Keenan, who researched, and join us again for another edition of The Rewind very soon.